Thank you, Stuart, for that introduction, and thank you so much for inviting me here. I'm going to have some time later to talk to you about my experience with autism, my son who has autism. But right now, I have the honor to introduce Dr. Daryl Treffert. Dr. Treffert has written a couple of the best books there are on Savant syndrome. In fact, I would think that he is probably the world expert on Savant syndrome. He's published, written a lot of articles, but the thing that I like the best about him and his books is that he is not just talking about the skills, the tricks these individuals do. He talks about their humanity. He talks about what these things that they do say about our brains, all of our brains, and the capacity of our brains to do things that we don't expect them to be able to do. And he also has become friends with many of the most famous individuals who have autism or have Savant syndrome. You'll notice, if you read Daniel Tammet's book, that he wrote the introduction to that book. And one of the things I can say that most greatly recommends him is that he likes these individuals, and they like him. And as a mother of an individual on the spectrum, to me, that's actually the most important thing. So I hope you will enjoy as we get to hear from Dr. Daryl Treffert.
Thank you, Julie, for that very kind introduction. I appreciate it. And it's great to be in Ann Arbor, if only electronically. I have a daughter who lives nearby in Birmingham, and we've come to like Michigan very much, and I'd be there myself except for a schedule conflict which prevents me from being there in person. I think your choice of Born on a Blue Day for your community read is a great one, and I'll try to provide some background that I hope will be helpful. Daniel Tammet, who I know well, is certainly an extraordinary person, and as was mentioned, he can do some extraordinary things like memorizing pi to 22,500 digits or learning a Icelandic language in only 7 days, let alone his math skills, which are extraordinary. Daniel does have Savant syndrome, but unlike so many other savants, as mentioned, he's able to tell us not only what he can do and show us what he can do, but he can tell us how he does it. And that's a remarkable insight for those of us that are interested in better understanding Savant syndrome. I first learned about Daniel in 2004 when he memorized pi in London. And I was particularly interested because in his description of his abilities, he said they began suddenly after a series of epileptic seizures when he was 4 years old. And that puts him into what I call the acquired savant syndrome category. That is, persons who otherwise are neurotypical, who have some kind of incident, and then suddenly have some unusual powers or abilities, which I think speaks to the dormant potential within us all. We'll talk about that later. I then met Daniel in person in Milwaukee when we were filming Brain Man, which I hope many of you have seen. If you haven't seen Brain Man, you should, because you'll meet Daniel up close and personal. Later, Daniel asked me to write the foreword to his book that came out in London, which I did, and I think you have copies of that. In that foreword, I mentioned how marvelously his book provided insight not just into the mind, but into the world of Daniel Tammet. And finally, that while in the past numbers were his friends, he made so many friends through this book, including you in Ann Arbor and me here in Wisconsin. As a favor to me, he then wrote the foreword to my book, Islands of Genius, The Bountiful Mind of the Acquired Autistic and Sudden Savant. And in that foreword, he made a very valuable suggestion. He said, rather than using the term disabled, Dr. Treffert, Daryl, why don't you use the term differently abled? And I think that's a great suggestion, because if we see these people as differently abled rather than disabled, then we concentrate on their strengths rather than their limitations. Now, Daniel, like all savants, has really two conditions. He has Asperger's syndrome that Dr. Donnelly will tell us more about this evening. So I'm going to concentrate on the savant syndrome, which is grafted onto the Asperger's syndrome. If you saw the movie Rain Man, Raymond Babbitt was autistic, but grafted onto that were some special abilities that that came through in the movie. I had the privilege of being a consultant to the movie, and I must say I was very pleased that it was accurate and sensitively done, and I think it put autistic savant into household terms. So I'm going to concentrate on savant syndrome and let Julie tell you more about autism and Asperger's. Savant syndrome is a rare but remarkable condition in which people with developmental disability or some other brain injury or disease have some remarkable island of genius that stands in stark contrast to overall limitation. The skills are unusual in that when you consider all the things in human repertoire, savant skills tend to narrow down to art, music, calendar calculating, lightning calculating, and visual, spatial, or mechanical skills. Whatever the skills, it's always linked with massive memory. I met my first savant in 1962. I started a children's unit at the hospital here in Wisconsin. And we got 30 autistic youngsters on this unit, and three of those caught my eye. One little guy had memorized the bus system of the city of Milwaukee. And if you told him the time of day and the bus number, he would tell you what corner that bus is going by just then. Another little guy was a walking almanac of history, what happened on this day in history, and I could never trip him up. And a third little guy was mute, severely autistic, but if you put a 250-piece jigsaw puzzle on the table in front of him, upside down, picture side down, he'd put it together just from the geometric shapes with the rhythm of a sewing machine. Then in 1980, Leslie Lemke came to Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, where I did the concert. Now, Leslie is blind, he's cognitively disabled, but is a marvelous musician. My daughter was at the concert. I actually wasn't at the concert, but she came bounding home. She said, Dad, I saw a miracle. I said, what'd you see? She said, I saw this lad, he's cognitively disabled. He has never had a music lesson in his life, and yet he has a musical repertoire of thousands of pieces. I said, well, honey, that's a miracle. But it's also something we call the savant syndrome. Well, Leslie, that Christmas, Walter Cronkite used the story of Leslie and May Lemke as his Christmas story, and Leslie became a celebrity. He began to make the rounds of the talk shows, the Oprah, Geraldo, Nightline. But in October 1983, 6 minutes program called Genius. Some of you may have seen that. I go around the country talking about this. Many people remember that program. Leslie, the musician, Alonzo, the sculptor, George, the calendar calculator. Watching that program was Dustin Hoffman. And Dustin Hoffman was moved to tears by the story of Leslie Lemke. See that clip actually a little bit later. And it was then he decided to play the savant. And of course, with that, savant syndrome became a household term, and as they say, the rest is history. Let me start then with an overview of savant syndrome, and so let's play the first clip.
The human brain is the most mysterious piece of matter on Earth, and the more we know about it, the more magical the whole system seems to be. However, it is only now in the 21st century, with new techniques, that scientists can for the first time open up the secret chambers in our heads and watch the complex system of hundreds of billions of neurons at work. Among scientists' most fascinating subjects of study are a small group of enigmatic talents, the so-called savants, the knowing ones. Savants can multiply five-digit numbers in their heads, or know 12,000 books by heart, or play a melody on the piano after hearing it only once. Over half of savants are autistic. Others develop these superhuman talents only after a brain injury. Experts all over the world are now starting to ask themselves, is it in fact a defect that turns a person into a genius? Hollywood star Dustin Hoffman won an Oscar for his portrayal of a savant in the film Rain Man. He dedicated his Oscar to the real Rain Man, Kim Peek, who inspired the movie. thereby honoring both Kim and all other savants, the guiding lights of our journey into this world of beautiful minds. Experts all over the world are now working on the question, is there a hidden genius within all of us?
Until we can understand the savant, we can't understand ourselves. And no model of brain function is going to be complete until it can fully account for this incredible disparity.
What I'd like to do now is to introduce you to several savants, because savants are better seen than described. The first one is Stephen Wiltshire, who is a marvelous artist. He can fly over a city in a helicopter ride for 15 minutes and then spend 5 days drawing it window by window and column by column. And what you're going to see is his pictures after he flew over Rome. So let's roll clip two.
Stephen Wiltshire from London is a star among savants. His nickname is the Living Camera. Stephen is autistic. He lives in a world of his own. Communication is difficult for him. He didn't speak his first words, pencil and paper, until he was 5. Yet when he was 11, he drew a perfect aerial view of London after only one helicopter ride. Even the number of windows in all the major buildings in his drawing was correct. For this film, we're testing the Living Camera in Rome. Stephen has never seen the Eternal City from above before. After only a 45-minute helicopter flight, we'll ask him to draw a 5.5-yard panoramic picture of the historic city center without having a second glance at it. Stephen has 3 days. In these 3 days, Stephen will have to keep thousands of details in his head. The innumerable cupolas, the tiny winding streets, all the balconies and windows of the endless array of houses, and each and every column and window arch of Rome's major sites, from the Pantheon to St. Peter's to the Colosseum. Five and a half yards of paper can look scarily empty. The amazing thing, Stephen starts the drawing as we would, with the Church of St. Peter's. But he doesn't do any sketches, nor roughing out of the space for the drawing. It's as if the panorama already existed within his head, with all the proportions, all the roads, all the details. At the end of the second day, Stephen is a good halfway through his creation. After 3 days of his drawing marathon, even Stephen Wiltshire starts to tire. He has filled in more than 5 yards of paper in fine pencil. He has been restlessly aligning window to window and house to house, because Stephen loves to be applauded for his art. In the left corner, he's finally reached the ruins of the Forum Romanum. Stephen's sister Annette is rejoicing with him. He's made it. Obviously, he's pleased with his work. Yet our vexing question still remains. How precise was Stephen's ability to memorize? Is it really true that you could only see a single curve of the Tiber from above? We started to compare the accuracy of the drawing with the real thing. Is Stephen's version of St. Peter's cupola too dominant? Yet here again, like with the curve of the Tiber, Stephen is frighteningly right. And, despite our doubts, Stephen has drawn one of the most complex buildings, the Colosseum, so precisely, it's practically a blueprint of reality. Stephen was also accurate in the instances we checked of nameless buildings and side streets. Had he had more time, his sister Annette believes, he would have put in even more detail.
Stephen has been doing other cities as well, and as I said, they're accurate window by window and stone by stone, and it's simply phenomenal that he can do that. Last year he did New York City, and he told me after he did New York City, Dr. Trefford, he said, this is the last one of these I'm going to do. And I said, how come? He said, I'm bored. And what happens with savants, and by the way, he's just a marvelous person, but what happens with savants is they begin with this spectacular replication ability. They do get a little bored, and they begin to improvise, and finally they begin to create. And so the myth that savants are simply human tape recorders or human cameras is not so. They can, in fact, be very creative. And his work of New York City now is in the international terminal, has been blown up 250 times in size, and greets persons as they come to this country. Other savants have musical ability. So let's meet another one, and this is Leslie Lemke.
It's so nice to have you back where you belong.
It's hard to say what's more striking about Leslie Lemke, his skills as a pianist or his amazing life story. Leslie was born with cerebral palsy and a rare disease that necessitated the removal of his eyes when he was only a few months old. Many might pity, but who could handle the challenge of raising such a child? May and Joe Lemke of Milwaukee, Wisconsin did. They adopted Leslie when he was just 6 months old.
He was very ill, felt that he wasn't going to live, and so they called up May Lemke, who was a nurse governess that they knew about, and asked her if she would take him in to her home, essentially, to die. And she said she'd take him in, but she said he's not going to die.
Using patience and love as their inspiration, May and Joe worked with Leslie, attempting to achieve not the miraculous, but the mundane. Functions such as walking, swallowing, and eventually swimming all took effort and endless practice. It seemed the only way Leslie would ever even approach a normal life would be through a miracle. Late at night, one evening, a miracle did occur.
When he was about 14 years old, they watched the Sunday night movie, which happened to be Sincerely Yours, and the theme song is Liberace's theme song, which is Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto. They watched, and Leslie listened because he's blind, and they went to bed. And then about 2 or 3 in the morning, May woke and heard some music coming, and she asked Joe, hubby, did you leave the television on? No. And so she went, and there was Leslie playing Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto from beginning to end, having heard it one time.
Yeah. And I said to Joe, hey, Joe, did you leave that television on? He said, no, why? I said, listen, where's that beautiful music coming from? And he said, so I got up, went to the boy's room, and I had got that little piano in his room, and the boy had suddenly slid over like this onto that chair, played all the way through.
Does he know how to play something so meticulously that he's never even heard before?
Well, I think that a part of the brain is the musical part of the brain that's left by itself because the brain was damaged. But I think that that part was left perfectly healthy and beautiful, just so that Leslie would have a talent of some kind, and he got it.
May's description is not very scientific, but it's actually quite accurate. Because what happens in savant syndrome is that there is damage, usually to the left hemisphere, and then there is recruitment of still intact cortex, generally from the right hemisphere, and rewiring to the right hemisphere and release of dormant potential. So that her idea about one area being damaged and another being recruited is really quite accurate. May is just a lovely person. She died in 1993, and her daughter Mary has taken over the care of Leslie. And Leslie has advanced remarkably. He not only improvises, but he now creates and is gotten to be quite witty and fun to be with. And his story demonstrates the power of faith and love and hope and patience that is so much a part of the savant syndrome. Yeah, we're involved with synapses and neurons, but a great part of the savant syndrome is the ability of the family to cheerlead, to reinforce, and to provide the kind of sustenance that creates the change. More language, better daily living skills, more social skills, and certainly Leslie and Stephen demonstrate that, and I'm sure you'll hear much more about that from Julie. Another savant is Kim Peek. Kim Peek is the Mount Everest of memory. Kim Peek has memorized 10,000 books, literally, word for word, and has the largest factual memory of anyone I've ever met, and I think of anyone who ever lived. Unfortunately, Kim died about 2 years ago, and as happens when a person dies, a library burns down. In his case, it's like the Library of Congress burning down with this huge factual memory. I wondered, what would it be like if we had two of the greatest minds among the savants together, Daniel and Kim? And so we had them meet each other, and this was their encounter. Roll the next clip, please.
If you're talking memory, though, there's one man who's in a league of his own. He's the world's most famous savant, and Daniel's next stop en route to California. Daniel makes his way to Salt Lake City's public library, where Kim and his father are waiting for him.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Let's walk down in here, we can have this.
They head off to a quiet corner, where Daniel can find out more about Kim's stupendous memory.
With total photographic memory, he remembers everything he's ever read. He can tell you the every city in the United States, its highways and its area codes and its zip codes and its television stations and its counties and when it was made a state. The history of any country, all the rulers and when they served, presidents of this country, when they were born, their wives, their families, all of NASA's accomplishments, when they went up, when they came down, what they're doing. He can talk to you about the Bible. He can quote scriptures. He can tell you anything about it you want to ask him about. Seems like everything he reads, he maintains. At 9 months, the neuropsychiatrist said he's severely mentally retarded. He will never be able to learn. You should put him in an institution, forget about him.
But Kim was reading encyclopedias by age 4 and had finished the high school curriculum by 14.
Fast can he read?
He reads a page that you and I would read in 3 minutes, approximately. It takes you about 8 to 10 seconds. He reads the left page of the left eye, right page of the right eye, and remembers about 98% of it.
Go back through here.
Kim, my birth date is January 31st, 1979.
It was a Wednesday, and this year it's a Saturday. We turned 2044 on a Sunday.
What year did Queen Victoria become Queen?
1837 to 1901.
Kim, if Winston Churchill was alive today, how old would he be?
130.
And what day of the week would his birthday fall on this year?
It would be on a Tuesday, the last day of November.
His parting words to me were, we looked into each other's eyes and he said, one day you'll be as great as I am. And that was a wonderful compliment and what an aspiration to have.
Kim was not immodest about his abilities, as you can tell from that clip, and I thought it was really interesting when he put his hands on Daniel's shoulders and said, son, you keep this up and someday you'll be as great as I am. Kim went on with his factual memory to develop a Google-like capacity, not just facts, but putting them together in ways that are really super intelligent, and I had trouble keeping up with him with some of his associations. For example, at one point I said to him, Kim, what do you know about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? And he said, Churchill. And I said, I don't get it. He said, well, Morse code for the letter B is dot, 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 and Churchill always had a letter V whenever you saw him, and then he recited one of Churchill's speeches. So he went on to develop what I think was a super language, hyper language, super intelligence, and I wish that we had had an opportunity to move further. That got him into trouble from time to time. He and his father were at a play recently, and Kim stood up in the middle of the play and he said, "Stop, stop the play." And the actor said, "Sir, what's the problem?" And he said, "You missed a word." And the actor said, "Sir, I didn't think anybody would notice, and I didn't think anybody would care." Well, he said, "Shakespeare would care." So Kim, when Kim died, I lost a friend, a good friend, and we lost, I think, a Mount Everest of memory, and I doubt that will ever be duplicated. I want to switch gears now a little bit and talk about the acquired savant. And the acquired savant are people who have some, are neurotypical people who, after an accident or injury, suddenly have savant skills. And what does that say about the dormant potential within us all? Let's meet one of those, Alonzo Clemons. Clip 5, please.
Deep in the mind of Alonzo Clemons is something that mystifies medical science. Every day, he leaves his condominium near Boulder, Colorado, boards the early bus, and reports to work as the custodian at the Boulder YMCA. Scientists say we all have something to learn from this man, even though he is severely brain damaged. You wouldn't know it from watching him at work, but Alonzo the custodian is also Alonzo the prodigy. The very same hands that clean mirrors and sweep the walks create art. Sculptures, produced with amazing speed, with a refined sense of form. Perfect work from a man who never took a lesson in his life. There have been fewer than 100 cases like Alonzo's reported in medical history. He is an extremely rare example of what researchers call a prodigious savant.
A prodigious savant is a person who has a mental handicap and has some skill and ability which stands in remarkable contrast to that handicap, but it would be spectacular even if it were to be seen in a normal person. You're looking at not one in a million, you're looking at one in a billion. It is an extremely rare condition.
Alonzo's case is even more remarkable because both his handicap and his prodigious talent were the result of a childhood accident.
At a very young age, Alonzo had a real bad fall, and it left him like this.
Alonzo suffered rather serious brain injury, and it was after that that his savant abilities really began to blossom.
The injury left Alonzo with an IQ of 50 and a very limited vocabulary. When asked where his sculpting power comes from, he always answers the same.
God gives the gift.
God gives the gift. Dr. Treffert believes the injury damaged the left hemisphere of Alonzo's brain. When the right side compensated, it somehow opened a hidden pathway to Alonzo's enormous talent.
One of the amazing things about Alonzo and other prodigious savants is how this skill often just explodes on the scene or catapults on the scene to everybody's amazement. They had no idea.
Alonzo's sudden skill was an obsession. When he was institutionalized, he spent so much time sculpting, the staff took his clay away.
One night after everybody was in bed, Alonzo climbed out the window, went onto the roof, and dug the tar from underneath the roof and started making little animals out of that. And at night, he would slip them under his bed so that they wouldn't catch him doing this. So it was just something he had to do.
To give Alonzo more inspiration, Driscoll suggested that his mother take him to the Denver Zoo.
Look, how pretty.
And not large.
Not large at all.
When Alonzo looks at an animal in the zoo, he looks at it in a different way than you and I look at it. He has the ability to store and retrieve memory in a way that most of us do not. He can call up an image that he saw some time ago. I mean, he doesn't have to go back and look at the picture to do his model. It's there. It's like the freeze frame on a digital VCR, and he can call that up and look at it in detail anytime.
Look at that baby's legs. Look at the legs. You see that? See the stomach? See the stomach?
head goes up into the leg there.
The geese.
Yep. He's looking at it now. And so when he gets ready to start, he does not have to look at it anymore. He's got a photographic memory. So the memory is there.
Back at the studio, as Alonzo begins to work, there's a transformation. His eyes suggest a deeper presence, the intense, trance-like concentration of the savant.
He's in his world. Nothing bothers him when he's working. Alonzo works very fast. In about maybe 45 minutes to an hour, he can do whatever he's making.
Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of Alonzo is that somehow he acquired artistic abilities that take years, even decades of study for others to master. It's a mystery even the experts can't solve.
We often think about people inheriting certain kinds of talent, but what the prodigious savant has goes beyond talent.
In fact, because of his injury, Alonzo may have tapped into a hidden knowledge of art inherited from his ancestors. And Treffert believes that we too may have such buried treasures in our brains.
With the savant who has access to these tremendous store of memory, what that means to me is that we have that storage up there also. Now we have to find out how we can access it.
We may not yet understand the inner workings of Alonzo's mind, but his unique abilities may provide a rare glimpse into the unknown potential within us all.
Alonzo is one of the most mellow people I've ever met in my life. He's just a delight to be with. And he also, by what I call training the talent, has gained much more language, is much more social, and is living quite independently. So that these skills of the savant are not frivolous or gee whiz, look at that episodes. They rather are the language that these people use. And as we train the talent, they gain in these other ways as well. And Alonzo is an example of that. Likewise, with the replication to improvisation and now reading some of his own work. Let's move quickly on to one more acquired savant. Let's run the next clip of Audrey.
And unlikely artists.
And then we go in.
People like 87-year-old Audrey Sear of Mandeville, Louisiana.
I think it's perfect, Audrey.
4 years ago, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. That's when her amazing ability was suddenly unleashed. Talent she'd never shown before, not once in her entire life.
This one?
When you see someone like Audrey Sear and you can see her painting,
perfect.
You know that that dementia has unlocked something and that this would never probably have occurred if it hadn't been for that degenerative disease. This is a normal healthy brain here, and this is a patient with dementia. This white here represents fluid. And the fluid is there because the brain has atrophied. It has been lost. And this is the language area that has lost tissue.
That's the left hemisphere of the brain, the area damaged in both an autistic child like Jonathan and an Alzheimer's patient like Audrey.
Mm-hmm. It's pork chop, isn't that good?
It's called pork chop. Mm-hmm.
Somehow, the damage on the left side actually strengthens the right side.
Yet, this visual part of the brain, I think the right side of the brain, is suddenly expressing itself in a way that it never had before, and it's expressing itself in picture.
It's the silver lining to this tragic disease, and here we have this incredible legacy that our family will cherish, and they're pieces of her heart that she's giving to us.
Dr. Miller's patients suffered frontotemporal dementia. They lost cells in parts of the brain that regulate social behavior. These imaging studies reveal similar left brain injuries to those of savants Robin had been studying. This is exciting new evidence that, for the first time, is taking us closer to discovering the cause of savant syndrome. Could savant genius lie dormant deep inside everyone's brain? our savant skills merely obscured by layers of normal, everyday reasoning. The possibility that we all possess hidden genius is tantalizing.
Well, we don't have time tonight to talk about genetic memory. I wish we did, because it is this reservoir of knowledge and ability and skills that resides within all of us. The question is, how can we tap that without having a stroke or getting hit in the head by a baseball or having some kind of a concussion? I'm running into more acquired savants now. Derek, for example, is a gentleman who had a concussion diving into a swimming pool and then began to brilliantly play the piano, which he had never played before, and he now is making his living playing the piano. Or Dr. Tony, who is an orthopedic surgeon in New York, who was struck by lightning and survived, and began to get this obsession with classical music. He now is performing concerts as well as performing surgery. It's interesting in these individuals that there is no trade-off. With Alonzo and Audrey, there's a trade-off of their abilities for their skills. But now, as I run into acquired savants where there's no trade-off, that raises the ante a great deal in terms of being able to find that what I call the little Ray man within each of us. And Daniel Tammet is a good example of somebody who has brilliant gifts with very little trade-off. He certainly excels. Daniel is now writing a book of essays about math and life as his third book, and he is also working on a novel, which will be his fourth book, and I look forward to seeing those. The fact that the acquired savant can exist without this kind of trade-off is amazing. When I first began to look at savant syndrome, I assumed that from the damage there was a compensation, that the person, like a blind person, began to hear better. But I'm convinced now that it isn't a compensation at all. It's rather the release of dormant potential, or what I call the little green man within each of us. And the task now is to try to find out how can we make ourselves smarter? Can we enrich our experience by what I call rummaging around in the right hemisphere instead of spending all of our time in the left hemisphere. Well, we don't have time to explore that, but I hope it'll get you thinking on the way home, not just about the savants and their abilities, but what about your own buried potential, and how can we tap some of that and actualize ourselves? Well, let me sum up this way, that on my journey with savant syndrome, including the valuable opportunity to meet Daniel Tammet, I've learned some things. I've learned that in every handicapped person, there is an island of intactness. It may be small, it may be an island of genius, but there is an island of intactness. And our task is to discover that, to nourish it, to tend it, and let it come forward. And I've seen that happen now in so many persons with autism or Asperger's, as we find that island of intactness and nourish it, and it comes forward. And I'm sure Julie will talk more about that. We need to search for, discover, and encourage and nurture this skill in these different able persons, wherever it exists and whatever quantity it exists. Savant syndrome is really a three-legged stool. There is idiosyncratic brain dysfunction that we talked about briefly. There is this gift that these people have. But the third part of the stool is the family. The love, the concern, the loyalty, the patience, the belief, the faith that the families have is such an important propellant in this whole process. And I've been inspired by it. I've learned as much about matters of the heart as I have about matters of the head or mind in these remarkable people and their families. And the caregivers that are so dedicated to these individuals, we owe them so much. And I see so much coming from their efforts. Third, the savant syndrome, as I said, particularly the acquired savant, hints at dormant potential, a little rain man within us all. That's my mission presently, is to try to discover that and to find out how we might enhance our abilities. So finally, savant syndrome provides a unique window into the brain. And until we can fully understand and explain the savant, we cannot fully understand and explain ourselves, because no model of brain function is going to be complete until it can explain this juxtaposition of ability and disability in the same individual. Let me close with a clip with Daniel's explanation as he looks at Savant syndrome and Tammet's explanation and see what he might tell us about this remarkable condition. So let's run the last clip.
I think Daniel's ability is at a prodigious level because it would be spectacular if that were to be seen in any of us. It would be spectacular.
Equally, though, Daniel has been blessed with almost miraculous good fortune.
The line between profound talent and profound disability seems really a surprisingly thin one.
The way Daniel can describe his inner world is giving scientists a window into the brain that they've never had. But the truth is, their journey of exploration is only just beginning.
The bigger question is whether we all have some of those abilities within us, and that is what I refer to as the little Rain Man within each of us.
What I do, it isn't, I don't think it's supernatural, I don't think it's something that can't be explained. Who knows, there may be abilities here that everyone can perhaps tap into in some way.
Savant syndrome is challenging us to think in new ways about intelligence and what intelligence is.
So, thank you for the opportunity to share with you some of these thoughts about Savant syndrome. If you go to www.savantsyndrome.com, you can learn much more about it. It's a website I maintain with the Wisconsin Medical Society on Savant syndrome. You'll see many more video clips of these individuals as well as Daniel. Also, my book, Islands of Genius, if you want to learn more about the acquired Savant and about Savant syndrome in general, Islands of Genius will be a resource as well. Daniel sends his regards. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you. Maybe sometime we can talk about some of these matters in more depth. Let me close with a final quote that Savant syndrome is a mix of scientific interest and human interest. And studies ahead on Savant syndrome, I am convinced, will propel us further along than we've ever been in understanding both the brain and human potential. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very, very interesting. And Dr. Trevert talked a lot about Savant syndrome. My son has a number of Savant skills. He's got almost a photographic brain. He, you know, takes inner pictures of things and learns them and remembers them. He especially is interested in geography and history. He knows so much about history and maps. He's not good at math. There's a lot of different Savant skills, and not everybody is good at math, and definitely not John Paul. He's very good at music. You know, he remembers all details about music. He can sing you songs, all the words to songs, and he can name the musicians. But I want to tell you that I'm not really that proud of those things. The things I'm proud of are that he is a functional human being. He's managed to make it through high school. He got a college degree. He got two master's degrees. He's been married for about 8 years. And he gave me a 2-year-old grandson. And those things mean so much more to me than anything that he can memorize or stand up and do that is very unusual for other people. I'd like to tell you our story. Let's see, where's my clicker here? You can't see this slide too well, but in the middle is Jean-Paul when he was about a year old. And at that time, we thought he was normal. He was a bit unusual. But we'd never heard of autism. We didn't have any idea he had autism. For many individuals with autism, it's not apparent till they're a little bit older. Some of them appear normal. Some of them have regression. Some of them lose skills. And then we start thinking, what is wrong with this child? By the time he was three, coming up to three, there were a lot of characteristics. He screamed to communicate. Now, what I mean is, if he wanted something, he didn't say, I want. He couldn't say, I want. He couldn't answer a yes or no question. He couldn't tell you anything about his needs, but he would scream, and I would figure it out. And sometimes when we would talk to him, it was like he couldn't hear. And when we first took him to the doctors, they said he was deaf. I knew he wasn't deaf because he was listening to music and he could tell you the name of the musician. He could sing all the words. He didn't know he had a name, but he could name the person singing the music. So what he had, and I didn't understand then, was echolalia. I didn't have a degree in speech or anything. I didn't realize there was a difference between speech and language. But there is. There are individuals who can talk and repeat things. Jean-Paul could repeat his ABCs. He could point at the numbers. He knew those things, but he didn't have any way to tell you what was going on with him. Jean-Paul enjoyed throwing things. He would empty his room. We had a little gate over his room, and everything went out over the gate. For some reason, he liked throwing things. He knew his ABCs. As I said, he would point them out everywhere. Taking him to a grocery store was crazy. He knew his numbers, and he liked to sit and read books. Now, I don't mean children's books with pictures. He would have regular adult books with no pictures, and he would turn the pages, and his eyes would go up and down the page. And we thought he was just pretending to read, as it turned out. He had what we call hyperlexia. He was an early reader, and we don't know where he learned to read. Many children with autism are picky eaters, but there are some kids with autism who, instead of being picky, eat obsessively. And Jean-Paul could eat massive amounts of food. And he would scream for food. He wanted more and more food. At one point, he seemed insensitive to pain and temperature. We were living in northern Minnesota. He walked out at 30 degrees below zero in his bare feet and didn't seem to feel it. He burnt himself on the stove, and he didn't tell us. We just had to see the wound. He really didn't relate to other people. He wasn't interested in other children. The one, I guess, good thing was that he was close to me. He hung on me. He was very dependent on me. As I later began to realize, it wasn't the typical closeness of a mother-child. He really saw me as an extension of himself. I was the part of himself that got things for him, that made things happen. He was not interested in other children. He wasn't interested in toys. He didn't play typically. He was obsessed with, and he screamed for, music. He wanted to have music in his life all the time. And when we had the record player on, he would be right there at the record player, and he would watch the record spin around, and he'd go deeply into a trance, further away than he had been. And that was kind of scary. I don't know if all of you remember records. Records were like, before CDs and before tapes, we had these things we called record albums. And also, he was getting up to two and three, and most kids at that age, they wanted to do things for themselves. You know, they wanted to try to put their socks on. He didn't do anything for himself. He just stood and let things be done for him. All this was happening, and I was in what we call denial. I still hadn't realized there was something that was terribly wrong. And then he started to escape and run away. Now, I know there's some parents of children with autism here, and they know what I mean when I say he was a runner. Very, very scary. What we did, you know, early on, when we were taking him to the doctors, they had said that he was autistic, and we were fortunate. You know, it was 1971, and they did tell me that he was autistic. But they told me that he had autism and there was nothing that could be done for it. They wanted to put him in an institution indefinitely. And I refused to do that. But I didn't know what to do. And I ended up marrying a man who did have some background in autism. And we put our heads together and developed a program to work with him. There wasn't any place to take my son at that time in the early 70s. And so we began working with him in our own home. And we did a number of things. I'm going to tell you these here. I'm not sure that they were all right. Now, after many years of working in autism, I know that we did hit on some of the most essential things, but perhaps not everything was something we would choose to do again. One thing we did was to simplify his environment. We moved to the country, and life was just more basic and more simple. And we hoped that that was a way that we helped him understand what was going on better. We also improved his diet. But this was before we knew anything about gluten casein-free diets or anything like that. We just made his diet healthier. We also increased his level of physical activity. Now, for some of you parents who have children who are hyperactive, that probably doesn't sound good. But Jean-Paul was hypoactive. He was underactive. And some of our kids are alternately hypo and hyper. But as we found out later, Jean-Paul had a brain injury in the motor area of his brain. And movement was hard for him. So we didn't know that at the time, but we could see that he didn't move as much as the other children. And so we made him get involved and move more. I think that was a very positive thing. We established a much more structured day for him. Before we established this program, he was sort of in charge. He ran me around. He had me do what he wanted. But with our new home program, we established a structure of the day. And we do know now that structure is really important for kids with autism. We also created behavior programs to teach him things. Now, in this day and age, there are a lot of behavior programs, and there's some of them that are from, say, LOVAS, UCLA. Sometimes they're called early intervention programs. And a lot of those, you're sitting across a table and you're doing drills with children. Well, our program wasn't like that. We were having programs to teach him the things a child his age should learn. So the most important thing was to communicate. But it was also to dress himself, to brush his teeth, to eat, to take care of himself. So we created programs around natural situations, things that he needed to learn. And we used his obsessions as reinforcers. And the main obsession we used was food. He wanted food all the time. And I'll show you pictures of him. You'll see we didn't starve him. But after we gave him his first amount of food, we would insist he communicate to get seconds and thirds. And this eventually worked for him to help him learn to communicate. And here's another thing that I've never heard that anybody else did. We removed music from our lives for 2 years. I'm still not absolutely sure that was right, but as I said, he was so obsessed with music. And when we would put the record player on or the radio on, he would be right there, and he would be lost in the music. And one of our big goals was to bring him back into our world. And we thought about it and talked about it for a long time, and we decided that music was taking him away from us. And so we took the music out of our lives for a couple of years, and that was real difficult for us, too. But when we finally brought it back into our world, he could handle music. And music has still been a huge part of his life. But at that point in his life, at about 3 years old, he couldn't handle music. It was like an addiction. We also insisted that he start taking care of himself, brushing his teeth, putting his clothes on. That might mean we'd spend the whole morning working on those things. but we wanted him to do the things that were age appropriate. We had to ignore his screaming and insist that he communicate. Now, if you can imagine what was going on, life was hell. You know, we were making him do things that were hard for him to do and taking away some of the things that he really loved. You know, I have gone back to him and told him what we did, because there are some people, there's some philosophies that say that you can just really love your child out of autism, and that makes me feel a little guilty. But I'm not sure about that. Maybe that's worked for some people. But we really worked hard to get him back into our family and into our world. And in order to do that, you know, we used some tough love. You know, we used some hard strategies. And so he had to communicate to get what he wanted. He couldn't say yes or no. But one of the ways we would do this, if we were sitting around the dinner table, we'd give everybody first servings of foods. But when he wanted a second, he had to communicate. And we would go around from child to child and say, Sylvia, do you want some more potatoes? She'd say yes. Joe, do you want some more potatoes? He'd say yes. Lisa, do you want some more potatoes? She'd say yes. Jean-Paul, do you want some more potatoes? And he'd scream. Well, you didn't get potatoes for screaming. But as soon as he would start to model that, even begin with that, he'd get it for that. And we kept shaping that response until he could say yes. And then he would start getting the food. And eventually, we shaped it until he could ask for food. And that's how we worked him into communicating. We also insisted that he be a part of the family. I have seen in some families where, because their child is so strange and different, they didn't take their child with them to places because it was embarrassing. But we took him everywhere, and we insisted that he be a part of the family and that he do everything the family was doing. And one of the best gifts was that he had two sisters and a brother. And they were actually too young to understand he had autism, and they wanted him to play with them. And by gosh, they made him play. And it wasn't fun to watch. He had two bossy sisters. And, you know, at the time I thought, oh, they're being so mean to him. And I am like, thank God for those kids. Because they made him be a kid. They showed him how, and they made him be a child. When he was about 4 years old, we heard there was a school at the University of Minnesota. We were living in Minnesota, and they had a school for children with autism, and it was run by Dr. Uwe Stuker and Sheila Mercer. And we took him there, and Dr. Stuker looked at him, and he'd already made some progress, but Dr. Stuker reconfirmed the diagnosis of infantile autism and was very impressed with the progress that we had made. And I said, should I bring him down here to Minneapolis and have him be in your school? And he said, no, you're making good progress in your home. And he said, I'll be your advisor. And so from then on, he advised us on the strategies to use. But his first piece of advice was to get him into school. Well, surprise for the schools. It was a small rural school. They'd never heard of autism before. And so the first thing they were going to do was to test him. But he was untestable. They couldn't do an IQ test on him. He didn't have enough language. So they did a test they called the PPVT. And that's the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test. And there would be four pictures. And they would name one of the pictures, and he had to point to it. So it's a test of receptive language. He didn't have to say the word, but he had to point to the right picture. He was 5 years old. He scored 2 years, 5 months. And at that time, they took an IQ score off of that, and it meant that he was mentally retarded. But the school still took him, bless their hearts, and they had him in the kindergarten. He was, as I said, already reading some, but he had very little language, and hardly any social skills. I would come in every other day to help out that teacher, dear woman, and they started giving him speech and language services every day. Now that's remarkable at that time. This was before the public law 91-142, before the schools were required to take kids in. They could have turned me down just because he had autism. But they took him in and they worked very hard with him. And he started making progress. And when he was in first grade, they said, we think he should go to Mayo Clinic. And then Mayo Clinic can do an in-depth evaluation of him and give us some good suggestions. So I took him down to Mayo Clinic. And when I got down there, we saw a famous doctor. At least, they seemed to think he was famous. And he wanted us to have an IQ test, a visit with a psychologist or psychiatrist, and a chest x-ray. So they took him away from me and they gave him a Stanford-Binet IQ test, and he didn't have much language. So he scored in the retarded range. And I took him to see the psychiatrist, and he asked me to tell him about his childhood. And honestly, he kept going, aha, that's what you did to your son. You know, at that time, they blamed mothers for autism. They called us refrigerator mothers. We were so cold and rejecting that we made our children turn inward. So, and then I don't know what happened on the chest x-ray. We never heard about that. But, you know, the report that they sent back said that, well, they said he was retarded and I was hostile. Well, they were right on one. And it was very fortunate that the school already knew my child. And they knew that he wasn't retarded. You know, he was definitely had some neurological differences, but he also had some strengths. And by the time he was in the second grade, they gave him the PPVT again, and he was above his age level. He had made tremendous progress as far as language. Still, you know, autistic, but he'd made a lot of progress. Then, at that point, we moved from Minnesota to Missouri. And I have to say, Minnesota schools are a lot better than the schools in Missouri. And so we took a big step backwards. We were in a rural community, and he entered the third grade in this rural community school. And I was hoping he was doing well, because he started to do better up in Minnesota. But on the third day, I got a letter from the school saying that they were putting him in the class for the mentally retarded. So we still had that same battle. And I cried all that day. And then I went in the next day and I found out what was going on. John Paul, of course, was scared. You know, it was a new school. He had gone to the back of the room and he had started reading the Encyclopedias of World History at A. And we just sat there reading through the encyclopedias. The only things he responded to were the call for lunch. He got that one. And the call to go home. And so they were going to put him in the class for the retarded for reading too much. It was kind of unusual. And I said, no, you're not. You know, it was before I had the law to back me up, but I said, no, you're not. And then I went to the back of the room and I said, John Paul, get up and go to your desk and do what the teacher says. And he did. Now, that doesn't mean everything was solved, but that was the last time that they tried to put him in the class for the mentally retarded. This is, John Paul is the second from the left, and that's his first day of school. So, through grade school, he was very autistic. What he liked to do was read all the time, but usually not the right book. You know, he liked to read history books during math, and he didn't even hide it. You know, I've read novels in class, but I'd hide them. You know, he'd just be out there reading the book he was interested in. He memorized baseball statistics, and he wanted so much to be on the Little League, but he was very poorly coordinated, and so he really never hardly got to play. But he would sit on the bench, and the boys would ask him, oh, what was the average of so-and-so, or who won the World Series in 1957, and he knew all the statistics. He didn't have any friends, but he was really sort of in his own world, and it didn't bother him that he didn't have friends. He got very poor grades, and part of the reason was that he had very poor handwriting. It was pretty well illegible. He would lose his work, you know. I think any teachers that had him in those early days would think that he would never have graduated from high school. He liked to collect maps. He liked to make lists. He'd make lists of all the cities in the world with 50,000 people or more. Now, nobody was interested in reading his list, and nobody could have read his list because they were illegible. But he says that was fun. That's what he liked to do. He was reading the Encyclopedia of World History or any history books he could get his hands on. But we found out, finally, when he was 12 years old and in sixth grade, we found out that he had a vision problem. Now, he had glasses for nearsightedness, but one of the eye doctors said, you know, there's something more than nearsighted going on. And we took him to a developmental optometrist. And that doctor watched him when he read, and he said, you know, he only uses one eye at a time. I didn't know that. I mean, if you'd asked him to sweep the floor, you know, he'd sweep the floor, but nothing was clean, you know? He couldn't see things very well, but we didn't understand that it was about his vision. So what he did was he gave him prism lenses that helped his eyes to start work together. And John Paul said it was painful, and it took a while, but pretty soon his handwriting became almost legible. So it was have something to do with his eyes. And I really believe there are a lot of our kids with autism that have difficulty with their vision and that we don't know it because they can't tell us what they're seeing. And obviously, he wasn't seeing what we were seeing. And the prism lenses, in his case, really helped him improve his vision. In sixth grade, his teacher was Mrs. Ince, and she'd taught for something like 45 years. And she said, Julie, would you let me just have Jean-Paul in my class? And so I did. She had a big class, but she put him front and center, right in front of her desk. And when Jean-Paul would space out, she'd take her big paddle and she would crack it over his desk. This is not probably legal anymore. But he would jump and he'd be back focusing again. And she would also send Jean-Paul out of the class and talk to the other kids and say, you know, we're all different in some ways. And Jean-Paul is different in this way. And she really helped him because she got him back in the mainstream. However, that was also when the bullying began at that period. Now, there may have been some going on before, but Jean-Paul didn't realize it. He was just in his own little happy world. But in sixth grade, they got really tough on him. He talks about being de-pantsed a couple times in the hall, having his pants pulled down. And he said they'd get him in the bathroom, and it'd be threatening and physical, and it was the start of a period of time that was horrible for him. Second grade. See, I think he was cute. So by the time he was in junior high, he had gotten very depressed. He had kind of woken up and was aware that he was different. And he wanted to be like everyone else, and there's no way he could be. And so he got depressed, and he was talking suicide. It was really, really scary. And I ended up taking him to a neurologist. And this is when they found the brain injury in the motor area of his brain. And the neurologist said, you know, he's not depressed. He's frustrated as hell. Here he is, a kid who is very, very bright, but who can't make it come out. And I think there are a lot of our kids like that, with, you know, with some ability to think, but not to get it out. He suggested to him that he do, because he loves sports, that he do some sports that he could, were individual. And he ended up being on the cross country track team. And Jean-Paul considered that he won if he didn't come in last. You know, and it was good for him physically. He tried out for basketball, and that was a disaster. But they let him be the manager, and that meant he got to travel to the games with the athletes, which were the popular people. But then they would also play tricks on him, like, you know, they'd hand him a bottle of Coke that they had used to spit into with tobacco, and lots of tricks on him. But he still got to be a part of the group. And then when he was in high school, they let him be the tiger mascot. And he got to wear the tiger outfit and dance around. His brother and two sisters were athletes. And so it was very hard on him that he couldn't ever be an athlete. But he, you know, he got to be with the kids then. And then when he got into high school, he had a teacher who realized he had a history prodigy on his hands. And there was, at the local university, they had a history bowl competition, and all the schools, the city schools and the rural schools, put together teams to go compete. Those poor people, they didn't realize what they were coming up against. He was from a small rural school. There was a team of five. His sister was on the team, but she said the other four people just went along to get a day off. Because Jean-Paul was unbeatable. You know, he knew everything. He knew African history. He knew European history, Asian history. And they'd ask a question and, you know, he just won it all. And they beat all the big city schools, and he came home a hero. That was his sport. And they ended up electing him vice president of the student council. So by the time he finished high school, he had history scholarships and he had leadership scholarships for being in the student council. There's so much more I'd like to tell you, but I'm just taking a brief time here. And I want to show you, here he is in junior high. And this is during the time that he was really being picked on, and life was really tough. This is his high school graduation picture. And it was about the time that he graduated from high school that he was ready to tell people about his autism. And so the local city sent some reporters out and they interviewed him. And we had 2 pages in the city paper about his autism. At that time, that an individual with autism was graduating from high school was just remarkable. But he was ready to let people know, you know, why and how he was different. He went on to college. In fact, he had scholarships to college because of his history bowl and his leadership work. And people had told me, people in the autism community said, you know, you can't let him live in the dorm because he will be picked on. He was picked on. You know, one of the things I want to tell you parents is sometimes you have to let go and let them learn their lessons. And it hurt me. I would talk to other students at the school and they would tell me stories about what was going on. And it was so hurtful, you know, I cried. But at the same time, this is how he learned. You know, but people learned that you could ask Jean-Paul for money and he would give them money. You know, they would play tricks on him, tell him that there was a fire and he'd run outside in his underwear. You know, just horrible things. But there were good things too. He lived on the 6th floor of the dorm, and the boys on his floor started a rock band. And it was called Jean-Paul and the Six Pack. Now he said, Mom, it's a six pack of Coke. I don't believe it. But they were playing fraternity parties and they were playing at the student union. And one time when they were at the student union, I snuck in and I was there among the kids and watching the band, and I overheard the other kids talking and they were laughing at Jean-Paul. He's a great singer, but he didn't have any of the rock star moves, you know what I mean? You know, he would just stand there. And I was there, and one of these kids said, he has his pineapple shirt on again. He had two comfortable shirts that had pineapples on them, and it seems like that's all he wore. So they were laughing at him in his shirt, and generally laughing. It made me feel a little bad. And so after the band was done, I went up and I asked one of the guys in his band, because they were kind of cool guys, and I said, hey, how come you have Jean-Paul in the band? And he said, he's the one that knows all the words. So being autistic has some advantages. Anyway, it was wonderful for him, and many people did play tricks on him, but he did make friends in the student government, and he was active in his church group, and they were really accepting, and those were the people that remained his friends over the years. Learning to drive was another hard thing because of his poor coordination. Some of you maybe have kids who get occupational therapy. Well, I had an occupational therapist test him when he was in college. I'd never had the chance before. And she said he had what was called overflow, which means that if you move one part of your body, the other might move. So you move your right hand, your right leg might move. Or, you know, now imagine this when you're driving a car. Okay. Also, he had proprioceptive problems, and proprioceptive is understanding and feeling your own movement. So she had him close his eyes, and he couldn't really tell where his body was moving if he couldn't watch his body. Okay, think again about driving. Okay, you cannot watch your feet while you're driving. So really, I thought he would never drive. But he went to the Rehabilitation Institute in Kansas City, and they taught him to drive. And he has been driving, and to tell you the truth, he has had less accidents than I have. However, when he first took his test, he failed it because he was driving too slow. But he does drive. And in college, he was in leadership societies and honoraries. He did very well, except for algebra. That was a disaster. He did get his degree in history. And I am trying to make this story a little shorter and going over the many stories that there are, but he went on to get a master's degree in medieval French history. He loved it. His professors were just like him. But he finished that master's degree, and we realized that there just weren't any jobs out there for medievalists. He had been thinking about getting a PhD, but he realized that probably wouldn't do him any good. He was just going to have to sit around and wait for his professors to die. So he went on and got a second master's degree in library and informational science. And it was a much more useful degree. And right after he graduated, he got a job in a small disability library and had that job for 10 years. During that period, actually the first time that Jean-Paul and I spoke together at a conference was right after he graduated from high school. But we began to travel quite a bit, keynote conferences and speak together. And I enjoy speaking to groups, but it's much more fun for me when he's with me. But, you know, I'll explain a little later why he can't be with me at this time. But we were traveling quite a bit, enjoying it, speaking at conferences, and he became a disability rights activist. You know, he was state president of TASH, the Association for the Severely Handicapped. He was a leader in People First, and he learned that, you know, that it's not just autism, there's problems. He learned about all the different disabilities and how we have so much in common. And so he worked very hard to help out people so they wouldn't have to go through what he went through. He was living in his own apartment, he was driving a car, and he had a professional job. He actively participates in his church and sings in the church choir and was active in autism groups. And then, you know, after years and years of no success at dating, you know, he didn't have the skills. You know, it's hard enough to have a friendship, let alone a relationship with someone else. So, but he met this girl online, and they emailed each other a lot, and then they met each other, and then about 8 years ago, he got married. And not too long after that, he lost the library job because his grant was cut, and he had a heck of a hard time getting another job. As you can tell, he's a bright individual, but he doesn't have very good eye contact. And he read all these books about how do you interview, and they all said eye contact. And so he'd go into the interviews, and by God, he gave them eye contact. But he's often said, do you want me to look at you or do you want me to listen to you? I can only do one at a time. And so he was looking at them, but he wasn't looking at them the right way. You know, eye contact is an art. It's not staring. And the other thing was that he's also dead honest. And they'd ask him various things, and he told me once, well, they asked me what my worst traits are. I said, oh, no, what did you say? Well, he told them exactly what his worst traits were. You know better than that. You say, oh, I'm just a workaholic or something. But no, it took him a long time to get a job. And he now is working for Quest Diagnostics, which is something to do with insurance. It's not his favorite job. But he has a job, and it has benefits. So we're happy for that. I wanted to mention that when he was young and was eating so much, he was slim, but as he got older, it did catch up with him, and he had gained a lot of weight. But he did Weight Watchers, and that seems to be a really good program for a lot of individuals with autism, and he lost weight really well. Okay, here's Jean-Paul when he's speaking on a panel at a conference. And this is at the Autism Society of America, the 2000 conference. And he was given the award as Individual with Autism of the Year nationally. So we're very proud of him. And this is partly because of all the disability rights work that he had done. And this, he and I, when we spoke at a conference, we used to do quite a lot of it. Okay. So I just want to say, what were some of the things that made a difference? You know, he was different from Daniel Tammet, that in that he was classically autistic to begin with. And yet he's come to be a pretty functional person. He still has autism, but he functions in life. And we definitely think it was the importance of early intervention. The earlier we can get to our kids, the more we can help. Also, I mean, some people talk about miracles. This was no miracle. This was really hard work. You know, it was hard work on my part. I can't tell you how much during those first years he screamed and I cried, because it was tough to get these changes. But we were consistent, insistent, and persistent, and we made progress. Our number one goal was communication. I think that has to be the number one goal for kids with autism. We focused on getting him to be a part of our life, keeping him active and out of his, you know, interior things and there with us. I have to say that, you know, some individuals have such an organic difference or damage that they may not have been able to, with all that we did, they may not have made it, but so even some of the things that about him that we tried to change, we couldn't change because the neurological difference, and it's hard to change what's going on in the brain. We learned we have to educate people a lot about autism, and because, you know, he went into schools and people in the schools didn't know about it, his doctors didn't know about it, so it's been a lifetime project trying to educate people about autism. I learned to work with the schools. I learned to advocate for him. But I also tried not to antagonize the people that were going to be helping him. I learned to believe in myself and to believe in my child, because I can't tell you how many people told us we couldn't do it. You can't, you know, Mayo Clinic said autism is incurable by definition. And maybe it's incurable, but that doesn't mean our kids can't get better. One thing I regret is that I didn't enjoy him as much as I should have. I was already always worrying. I was always trying to help him do better. And I really wish I could go back and just enjoy that kid the way he was. This is his wedding. I spoke at a conference in Kuwait a few years ago, and I showed this picture, and the princesses of Kuwait cried. It was the fact that he was able to get married was just wonderful. But this one's even better. This is my grandson, Brett Beauvais. And you know how they say that people with autism can't love people and they can't be parents? That's not true. You know, he adores his son, and he's one of the primary caretakers and, you know, changes the diapers and loves that kid, I'll tell you. Okay, in the meantime, okay, when I had him, I had a degree in sociology, but I went back to school, became a special education teacher, because I was appalled that the schools didn't understand anything about autism, and I figured somebody ought to get in there and start teaching them. So I became a special ed teacher. I taught children with autism. Then I became an autism consultant, you know, and was teaching teachers in the schools how to work with kids with autism. I helped to found the Missouri State Autism Agency, which is called Project Access. I have been the associate director of Project Access for the last number of years, but I just retired at New Year's. I got a master's degree and a PhD in special education with a focus in autism. I've been speaking, publishing nationally and internationally. I have a private practice now called Autism Support Services. I retired from the public schools. I retired from being associate director. And my main work now is that I have a master's degree program that we've started at the University of Missouri. It's a master's degree in autism. It's totally online. So I have students from Japan, I have students from New Hampshire, I have students from all over the world. And we also have a program for people who have degrees in other fields besides special ed. For instance, if you're a nurse, if you're a social worker, if you're a speech therapist, and you want additional training in autism, we do this, and we do this totally online. So this is one of my biggest projects right now. I'm still teaching people about autism and how to help our kids. And so I'm going to end it with this. This little guy is my grandson, and he looks just almost like John Paul. It's amazing. And I want to say that I have been truly blessed. I feel like I have been blessed, although there were a lot of times in my life I didn't realize that, especially in those early years. I'd like to ask you, though, to think about these individuals. I know some of you are from the autism community, and some of you just read that book, and I hope it piqued your interest in not just savants, but in people on the autism spectrum. God made the world diverse. And the hardest thing for some of these individuals is not their differences, but the fact that other people don't accept them for who they are. So if you would learn to accept the unusual and love the differences, you would make a lot of difference in the world for these individuals. So thank you very much.